their status quo is to speak Spanish, to kind of take on this more, it's not educated to speak like that. And this demonization of indigenous people in a country that's mostly indigenous, they just until Pedro Castillo were not in positions of power. They weren't being appointed. Their perspectives were not being brought into policies. Their perspectives were not being brought into the proposed new constitution, which is something that has also been happening during the peak tide. A lot of these left governments have been rewriting their constitutions or codifying new laws. For example, Cuba just passed its family codes, and Chile, unfortunately, didn't vote, but they were looking to rewrite their own constitution. And so Pedro Castillo also represents and came from the Peru Libre Party, which, he appointed a Marxist-Leninist in his cabinet, which unfortunately the individual had to step down because shortly after being put into his position, he got death threats. And this just shows how status quo the career politicians want to keep Peru. Again, Peru, with such rich economy and such access to resources, has been a country that has been overexploited and underdeveloped. And this works to the benefit of these career politicians and to foreign interests instead of the interests of Peruvians. And so Pedro Castillo represented and still represents a move towards a new type of Peru, a Peru that is moving left and closer to a Peru for Peruvians themselves. And so this scares people that don't want that to be the reality because it doesn't benefit their pockets. Okay. And so that's why millions of Peruvians are out in the streets protecting and asking for his release.
Thank you for that. Arnold August, author and journalist from Montreal, a pleasure. And Libra Sankara, thank you. Contributor at the Troika Collective from Miami. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Miko Batawe and the team, it's goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran's top general says his country is determined to continue to develop its drone program, which is already among the world's top five. The Kremlin says Russia will never accept any price cap on its energy resources because it leads to destruction of the market pricing process. And the death toll from a severe Arctic freeze that has gripped the United States and Canada rises to at least 38, with millions under alerts. Our top story: Iran is standing among the world's top five drone powers, with its UAVs ranking high in terms of accuracy and endurance. Major General Mohammad Baqiri says claims by Western powers that Iranian-made drones are being deployed by other countries are part of the anti-Iran psychological warfare, yet they show that Iranian unmanned aerial vehicles are effective. The chief of the Joint Staff of Iranian Armed Forces says Iran has developed the drone capacity by using domestic resources and cooperation with domestic universities and research centers. The general stressed that Iranian Armed Forces will continue to develop their drone power and embark on relevant cooperation with other countries. Normalization deals between some Arab states and Israel continue to draw public anger. In Morocco, people have held protest rallies in more than two dozen cities to condemn ties with the Tel Aviv regime. The centerpiece of the protests was staged in the capital, Rabat, where demonstrators marched on the parliament. They chanted slogans and held signs calling the deal treacherous and demanding its cancellation. They also set fire to the Israeli flag and reiterated their unwavering support for the Palestinian cause. Israel and Morocco agreed to a U.S.-sponsored deal to normalize relations in December 2020. Three other Arab countries had already signed similar agreements with the regime. The agreements have been widely denounced by Palestinian groups and Muslim nations. And earlier in our news review program, we discussed Israeli normalization deals with a number of Arab states and the public backlash against them.
To discuss that further, we're joined by Barry Grossman, international lawyer, joining us live from Bali, and also Wafa al-Udaini, a Palestinian activist and journalist joining us from Gaza City. Thank you very much to both of you for joining us on this edition of the News Review. Let's begin with Barry Grossman. Now, we hear these people chanting slogans which are completely the opposite of the road that their government is going down.
From the beginning, that the policy embraced by Morocco's government is completely at odds with popular opinion in Morocco and indeed across most of the Arab world. In fact, something approaching or slightly exceeding 80% of people are fully committed to supporting Palestinians and the Palestinian cause without qualification, and in denouncing any normalization or what they like to call partial normalization with the occupation. So the starting point in understanding any of this has to be recognizing that these moves towards normalization, and they're very significant moves, I might add, are entirely contrary to public opinion in the nations involved.
So Wafa al-Udaini, it was interesting for us to see during the games, the FIFA World Cup, we saw Moroccans holding a Palestinian flag and, of course, expressing their unwavering support for the Palestinian cause, and that actually attracted a lot of attention.
Indeed, what happened with in the World Cup, indeed, it was like a slap to the, in the face of the occupation, because their main aim behind signing this agreement is to cut the ties between the Arab nations, to cut the ties between the Arab countries, and then weaken the Arab the Arabs more and more. But what happened exactly in the World Cup, and when we see the Moroccan national team raising the Palestinian flag, this thing, like, it was like an earthquake for the occupation, because, and even the Moroccan people, not only the national team, even the Moroccan people, we saw them holding the Palestinian flag beside the Moroccan flag. And this thing proves that their normalization and their assignment is against the people's will. And indeed, we all know that the Moroccan people are among the most supportive people for the Palestinian cause. So, and the protests that we see these days, indeed, another proof to this thing. So no matter they do for the Arab nations and the Arab countries, actually they will not hinder them from supporting the just Palestinian cause.
So Mr. Grossman, you just pointed to the rift between the people, the nation, and the government. And this doesn't seem to apply only to Morocco. We've seen this in other Arab countries that have normalized ties with Israel. We see that this is not a popular move, and the nation actually does not support the government's move of normalizing ties with Israel.
Absolutely. We're also seeing a lot of the same sort of sentiment in the wider Atlantic world. I guess what's important is that there seems to be a whole lot more understanding in Arab nations about what these 2020 Abraham Accords actually ceded to the occupation. So in essence, what's required under these accords is for the signatory country, in this case Morocco, to work with the United States and with the occupation to prevent any hostile action against the occupation whatsoever, and to essentially criminalize any support, external support, based in Morocco that might be construed as supporting hostile action, like, for example, armed conflict in occupied Palestine. And more importantly, it obliges Morocco and other signatory countries to fully embrace, fully submit to a U.S.-sponsored strategic agenda for the Middle East, which also involves regional security agreements and cooperating on intelligence and everything else. And finally, the accords stipulate that the signatory country may not enact any legislation which is in conflict with any part of the Abraham Accords, and that to the extent there is any conflict, be it with domestic legislation or other international treaties, that it's the Abraham Accords that prevail. So no small part of the independence of the signatory country has been signed away by signing on to these accords, which they like to characterize as a partial normalization, but it's in fact a complete rollover.
And Ms. O'Diney, in your opinion, do you believe that the public pressure and the popular movements can actually lead the governments to back down from the stances they have and having normalized their ties with Israel?
Yeah, of course. I do believe in the power of people, that they are the ones who put the pressure in their government and that they can change. I know that this step is a little bit late to change, but I do believe in the power of people. When they decide to do something, when they rebel, nobody can hinder them and nobody can stop them or even silence them, because this normalization deal, actually, it was based on something wrong. So for sure, this thing, this wrong thing is going to break one day, and the people will have their word one day, inshallah, and I hope very soon.
Thank you very much, Wafa Al-Udaini, a Palestinian activist and journalist joining us from Gaza, and Barry Grossman, international lawyer from Bali. Thanks for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review.
Turning elsewhere now, Russia says it won't give in to any price caps on its energy resources, adding the issue is out of the question. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said imposing such caps is unacceptable and that Russia is opposed to any interference in the process of market pricing. The European Union, the G7 group of developed economies, as well as Australia, reached an agreement on enforcing a ceiling of $60 per barrel on Russian oil in early December. Moscow has already said it plans to set up a mechanism which bans Russian companies from selling oil to countries imposing a price cap on Russian oil. And only Russia's nuclear arms are preventing the West from waging a war against Moscow. That's according to a top ally of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Former President Dmitry Medvedev says if Russia did not get the security guarantees it is demanding, the world would be on the brink of another world war and nuclear catastrophe. He, however, said Moscow will do everything to prevent that from happening. Medvedev, who is now the deputy chairman of Russia's Security Council, also says Moscow would pursue its war in Ukraine until, quote, the fascist regime in Kiev is removed and the country is demilitarized. Russian officials have time and again reiterated that the country's nuclear arsenal is a purely defensive one. They say Russia's policy on nuclear weapons is to use them if there is a threat to its territorial integrity. And Minsk says Iskander and S-400 missile systems deployed by Russian forces to Belarus are fully prepared and ready to perform their intended tasks. The Belarusian Defense Ministry said the country's servicemen and crew have fully completed their training in the joint combat centers of the Russian Federation and the Republic of Belarus. Russian President Vladimir Putin said in June that Moscow would supply Minsk with the Iskander and S-400 missile systems. The Iskander tactical missile systems are capable of carrying nuclear weapons. The S-400s are surface-to-air missile interception systems capable of engaging aircraft, UAVs, cruise projectiles. They also have terminal ballistic missile defense capability. The year 2022 is drawing to a close, and this is typically a festive time marked by happiness, but for many families in the US and the United Kingdom, this year has been especially hard as they had to deal with issues ranging from hunger to a cost of living crisis.
This Christmas is not a time for cheers and festivities for many in the U.S. A hunger crisis is affecting U.S. households. Food insecurity is already a critical problem affecting millions of Americans. One of the most typical factors affecting people suffering from food insecurity this time of the year are extreme winter conditions. But this year especially, many are suffering from hunger and high food prices due to unprecedented inflation that has gripped the U.S.
The gas, the food, everything, milk, and everything is high now.
It is concerning, so I always shop online to make sure that I can find the best for groceries and for like gas as well.
Last year, more than 33 million Americans lived in food-insecure households, including 9 million children. The figure dropped in 2021, thanks to COVID relief programs. One also does not need to look any further than U.S.'s food assistance program called SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, to see the severity of the problem. The federal government increased SNAP by 12.5% this fall, adjusted to the rate of inflation. In the fiscal year 2021, SNAP served an average of 41.5 million people per month. The U.S. President Joe Biden may boast of a minor drop in inflation.
And yesterday, we got data that showed that manufacturing orders were up, but cost increases in supply chain items were beginning to ease. The week before that, we got data showing that price increase may be beginning to ease as well.
But the fact of the matter is that the U.S. population is suffering from poverty, unemployment, a lack of affordable housing, and lack of access to health care. This is on top of systemic racial inequities. All of these factors have driven food insecurity that affects around 10% of U.S. households.
So the U.S. is not the only country suffering from food poverty. The U.K. is also experiencing the same issue, mainly due to inflation, which are at record levels in both countries. The rest of the world is also suffering from food inflation. The war in Ukraine has exacerbated the situation. When it comes to wheat production, for example, Ukraine's output has fallen by 40%, affecting millions of people worldwide. Moving on, the death toll from a brutal blizzard in the US and Canada has risen to at least 38 as the Arctic freeze continues to ravish North America. Officials say 34 people died across the US where the extreme weather conditions have struck the city of Buffalo in the state of New York the hardest. There, people were found dead in cars or snow banks. Around 200,000 Americans remain without electricity nationwide after the number peaked at 1.8 million on Saturday. Meanwhile, more than 50 million Americans remain under some sort of weather alert. The icy conditions have also taken their toll on neighboring Canada, where four people have died in a bus rollover accident. Blackouts are also reported in several areas, including in Quebec, where almost 120,000 households are without electricity.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer. Iran.
Hello. I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Suppose if I get closer, I can take a better picture. Let me see it. Uh-huh. That's it. This suspension bridge is one in a million. If I stand on this bridge, I can surely take better pictures. But I think it's a little bit scary. Much scary. Though, I'm brave enough. Before I forget, I've made a trip to Khalkhal County in order to visit Pir Taqi Suspension Bridge. And if you're brave enough, stay with me. Taqi Suspension Bridge is located in Khalkhal County of Ardabil Province, northwest of Iran. This bridge is one of the tourist attractions of the region, spanning 165 meters with a 60-meter height over the Qizil Ozan River. Constructed by professional engineers and workers, Pir Taqi Suspension Bridge is built with wire ropes and lumbers. This fantastic bridge was actually made for the convenience of Pir Taqi Dam construction workers, and today just a limited number of people can walk through it. A fabulous place for hours of rock and mount climbing, the attraction will amaze visitors. Some would like to stop by and watch the astonishing scene for a couple of hours. Photography lovers will adore the extraordinary glamour of the site. Mineral spas are part of the journey. The cool waters are so refreshing. For the venturesome trip, you might need comfortable shoes, raincoat, first aid kit, light meals, and bottles of water. I have to take a walk from the point I parked my car. Not a long way to go. You have to be well equipped, and I am, like always. Just imagine a hanging bridge with no column, no stand on the earth. Wow, this is what it is. Hanging between the sky and the earth. I am very eager to walk through it. I'm so close. Couldn't imagine to climb that high. Oh, some parts are very steep. Scary. prepared to fall. Kidding. It was a perfect route. But I have to climb carefully. What is important is that I can take great photos from that height. The stunning scenery. Mitra, resist! Resist! You can reach the top. Here's the last station. Amazing! Oh, wow! Look at the bridge. Built with wire ropes and lumbers. It has a wooden floor. I like it. It's unique. Let me see. What a photo. Now, let me walk through the bridge. You know, if you're acrophobic, you should avoid this bridge. And this bridge can only place a limited number of people. Otherwise, it would be very dangerous. Oh, yes. Hold fast to these wires, not looking beneath. It's a mixed feeling. Excitement, fear, suspension. Oh God, forget everything. Just look at the spectacular scenery. The river. Listen, it's roaring. Ghazal Ozan is one of the roaring rivers of Iran. Oh, I don't want to miss the landscape. Let me see. Aha, great. Ago, and I have to leave this astonishing bridge. It's a fantastic experience, but don't forget to take safety precautions into consideration. And if you're afraid of height, you can just enjoy the scenery around the bridge. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the latest war of words between the top diplomats of India and Pakistan at the United Nations, marking a fresh escalation. And we shall also look at India coming up with a rupee trade settlement mechanism to end the dominance of the US dollar in international trade.
Tensions between strained South Asian neighbors, India and Pakistan, have again reached a fever pitch following an intense war of words between top diplomats of the two countries at the United Nations just recently. The heated exchange between Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari and his Indian counterpart Subramaniam Jaishankar came after the UN Security Council issued a statement that warned of increasing dangers of terrorism. The two countries have often accused each other of terrorism and proxy war.
Speaking to reporters on the sideline of a UN Security Council meeting in New York on December 15, India's Foreign Minister Subramaniam Jaishankar called Pakistan the epicenter of terrorism. Earlier, the top Indian diplomat told the UN Security Council that his country faced the horrors of cross-border terrorism long before the world took serious note of it, in a veiled reference to Pakistan. On being asked to respond to his Indian counterpart's remarks, Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari said Indians continue to club Muslims and terrorists together. In a scathing counterattack, Zardari said Osama bin Laden is dead, but the butcher of Gujarat lives, and he is the Prime Minister of India, referring to Narendra Modi. Modi was chief minister of the Western Indian state of Gujarat when an anti-Muslim pogrom in 2002 killed nearly 2,000 people. Zardari, the youngest foreign minister in the world, said his country had lost far more lives to terrorism than India, including his mother and foreign prime minister, Benazir Bhutto. Taking strong umbrage to the top Pakistani diplomat's diatribe, India's foreign ministry spokesman, Arindram Bakshi, called it a new low. He said Zardari's uncivilized outburst was the result of Pakistan's increasing inability to use terrorists and their proxies.
The ties between India and Pakistan have been strained by many issues, mainly the dispute over the Himalayan region of Kashmir. The two countries have fought three wars and engaged in umpteen cross-border skirmishes over the years. They have also frequently accused each other of terrorism. Since 2019 in particular, the two South Asian arch foes have ended all political and diplomatic contact following terrorist attacks in India as well as Pakistan and the abrogation of Kashmir's semi-autonomous status by the Modi government.
The latest war of words between the officials of the two countries has to be seen in the context of political tensions that have rapidly escalated since February 2019, when a convoy of the Indian Army was attacked in Kashmir's Pulwama district, killing 46 soldiers. The attack was claimed by the Pakistan-based terrorist outfit Jaish-e-Mohammed. After that, India vowed to ensure the complete isolation of Pakistan. Islamabad has also accused India of carrying out attacks on the Pakistani soil. Last week, Pakistan's Deputy Foreign Minister Hina Rabbani Kaur said Islamabad has traced undeniable and indisputable links between India and acts of terrorism on Pakistani soil, and that the evidence was being formally shared with the United Nations, pertaining mainly to a deadly 2021 car bombing in the city of Lahore, among other incidents.
However, the issue that has led to the near total breakdown of political ties between the two countries was New Delhi's move to abrogate Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in August 2019. In September, during the 77th session of the UN General Assembly, Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif reiterated that sustainable peace and stability in South Asia is tied to a just and lasting solution to the Kashmir dispute. The Hindu nationalist government in New Delhi, however, has virtually closed the Kashmir file.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Syed Mohsin Abbas, a journalist and political commentator from London. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Abbas. Now, the top diplomats of India and Pakistan recently engaged in a war of words at the United Nations, with Mr. Zardari calling India's prime minister the butcher of Gujarat and Jaishankar referring to Pakistan as the epicenter of terrorism. Now, the question is, does this mark a new low in the Indo-Pak relations?
I think that India-Pakistan relationships at the best of times are fraught with huge difficulties and suspicion. That's just been the default position since 1947, when both countries were independent of Britain or the British Raj. Now, the latest spat that we've seen is interesting. Of course, it's a revisited sort of standard accusations and allegations of the past. I mean, the label of butcher of Gujarat is not something that's new. It's something that's been used by all sorts of commentators. And it's a fact that Prime Minister Modi has been basically the overriding ruler of Gujarat at the time when huge massacres took place. And a lot of what happened at that time left a lot to be desired. And the suspicion certainly was that his background as an advocate and a supporter of Hindutva nationalism and his links to the RSS is on record as well. So all these things about the BJP, Hindutva fundamentalism, you know, religious fundamentalism, and of course the links to the RSS leave Prime Minister Modi always vulnerable to these kinds of attacks and allegations. As far as the Indian side and their riposte or their kind of initial points about Pakistan and terrorism, again, these are standard old tropes that have been pushed about. The reality of the matter is that both nations have an interest in destabilizing the other, given that they have a nuclear standoff, given that they have a long-running dispute over Kashmir and many other issues.
Mr. Abbas, relations between the two strange South Asian neighbors have worsened since the abrogation of Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in August 2019. Do you see this deadlock breaking anytime soon?
No, there's no sign of that deadlock breaking. Kashmir is a real sticking point. On the one hand, of course, one knows that an army of almost a million, it's alleged, actually reside in Jammu and Kashmir, occupied Kashmir, as Pakistan would have it, and indeed as most of the Kashmiri population would have it. The Indians have continuously refused to give the plebiscite to the Kashmiris that are in their jurisdiction currently, on their side of the line of control. They've made life extremely difficult. They brutalized a lot of the population in the name of hunting down terrorists, alleged terrorists, but they've actually stuck curfews and created all sorts of traumas and terror in that province, no doubt about it. And the Kashmiris are unsatisfied, and we've seen cases of torture, arrest, arbitrary arrest, long-standing prisoners who have very little evidence against them necessarily, but political prisoners of conscience who are still languishing in Indian prisons. We've seen the harassment of women and children in Kashmir by the Indian occupying forces, and lots of other travesties that have taken place. Kurun Poshpura was one example of rape of hundreds of Kashmiri women, for instance. But of course, this is no new thing. What is new in Kashmir is that the Indian, military and occupation forces have now the legal writ and the backup of the government itself, mainland Indian government, and they have the writ to essentially allow geoengineering.
So while Kashmir continues to be the main bone of contention between New Delhi and Islamabad, what are the other key issues or areas that make the relationship complex and fragile?
Well, I think, first of all, it's really territorial integrity other than Kashmir. I mean, we'd have to bring into question Balochistan. India had about 30 consulates in Afghanistan during the period that the Americans were occupying that nation. And India was very much online to being the key beneficiary of any American success in Afghanistan. And the idea was that they would embed themselves on the eastern borders of Pakistan, thereby giving them essentially a kind of an encirclement of Pakistan. That didn't really work in the end. The Indians' forces and their internal operation there in Afghanistan had to pack up their bags and leave as the Americans left. The Americans didn't really consult the Indians about it, which strained their relations. But what it hasn't stopped is India continuing to fund the likes of the Balochistan Liberation Army, which is on the borders of Afghanistan and Pakistan. That region is still being thrown into turmoil. And the significance is that Pakistan has, in Balochistan, probably the biggest amount of wealth in the entire nation of Pakistan. It's alleged that maybe $10-12 trillion of everything from black diamonds to copper to gold, as well as oil and gas, all exist in that territory of Balochistan. Hence, breaking Balochistan and balkanizing Pakistan is a major objective of Pakistan for some time. So Balochistan, Sindh, and Punjab being separated, being destroyed, would as a composite body, would essentially defang Pakistan. So that's one major other area, and a huge struggle is going on there through the intelligence agencies, through sort of terrorist organizations, through sort of so-called liberation armies as well. So there's that, which is, I think, the major clash between the Indians and Pakistanis, other than Kashmir. Of course, they are competing rivals, even within the broader Belt and Road Initiative of China. So economically, China, being the huge power that it is and the emerging world superpower, if you like, desperately needs Pakistan at the moment, because they've got something called CPEC, a sort of road and rail transport system, which essentially allows China to export its goods via Pakistan to the port of Gwadar, which they built, the Chinese, and from there, obviously, distribute it around the world. Now, that makes really Pakistan a beneficiary of a huge potential economic, cash-in. And that was really something which India is not very comfortable with. And India has its own links in the Chabahar port and is competing on that level. So this economic competition for gas, pipelines, oil pipeline routes, this need for, the territorial, integrity of each nation to be maintained.
Last but not least, sir, under the Narendra Modi-led BJP government, India has adopted a tougher stance on Kashmir while reversing confidence-building measures that were taken by previous governments. So do you see the Modi government as a hurdle in the improvement of Indo-Pak ties?
Without a doubt, the Modi government is a hindrance. I mean, their fundamental ideology and their means of coming to power has been based on really religious fundamentalism, and Hindu religious revivalism has been their ticket to power. And by this kind of revivalism, they maintain a political hold on a very large number of the population. And if they were to have soft policies with Pakistan, I don't think it would benefit the BJP. They require almost this kind of enemy, a Muslim enemy across the border that threatens their security as a way of winning votes and whipping up more support for themselves in the next election.
There you have it, Mr. Sayed Mohsen Abbas from London. He's a journalist and political commentator. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Shazia Atamari, a member of Pakistan's National Assembly, praises Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari for his response to Indian counterpart at the UN, says Pakistan has lost thousands of lives to terrorism. Political scientist and journalist Shama Junejo cites Pakistan's Deputy Foreign Minister Hina Rabbani as saying that Islamabad provided dossiers to the UN on India's involvement in terrorism. Dhananjay Tripathi, who teaches at New Delhi-based South Asian University, notes that the war of words between the top diplomats of India and Pakistan at the UN is not good for diplomacy.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
In a sign that the dominance of the US dollar is coming to an end, with the world economy getting divided into Eastern and Western blocs, India's rupee trade settlement mechanism has reportedly elicited interest from many countries apart from Russia. This mechanism is designed to use the rupee instead of the US dollar and other major world currencies for international transactions. It comes amid gradual erosion in the dollar's dominance as non-traditional reserve currencies like the rupee slowly take center stage.
A recent report by Reuters citing official documents and sources said several countries have come forward to discuss the rupee trade settlement mechanism with India, including Tajikistan, Cuba, Luxembourg, and Sudan. The mechanism was introduced in July is already functional, with sanctions mad at Russia making use of it. The report said the Narendra Modi government in New Delhi is looking to bring countries that are short of dollars into the mechanism, with four countries already showing interest in opening special rupee accounts called Vostro. Mauritius and Sri Lanka have also shown interest, the report stated, and their Vostro accounts have been approved by the Reserve Bank of India. The report further noted that India continues to discuss the denomination of trade in rupees with trading partners, including oil suppliers, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. Details of a potential rupee dirham trade mechanism are being discussed by Indian and Emirati bankers, while talks with Saudi Arabia on a rupee rial trade mechanism are also underway. These developments suggest that India's central bank is trying to bypass the U.S. dollar for trade with countries amid rapidly shifting geopolitical dynamics, especially after the Ukraine war. The experiment has so far worked well with Russia.
The introduction of the rupee trade settlement mechanism, according to industry observers, is designed to remove bottlenecks involved in the import and export of goods and services which require payments in US dollars as the world's reserve currency. That, in turn, comes with the risk of forex rate fluctuations. That's where trade settlements in rupees comes as a panacea, removing risks involved with the US dollar. Instead of transactions in American currency, the invoice will be done in Indian currency if the other parties have a Vostro account.
Reserve Bank of India, the central banking institution that manages the country's major monetary policies, on July 11 unveiled the rupee settlement system for international trade aimed at boosting trade with other countries with a focus on exports from India. The mechanism took immediate effect and required banks to seek prior approval. A notification issued by the Reserve Bank of India said the move was taken to promote the growth of global trade with emphasis on exports from India and to support the increasing interest of the global trading community in Indian rupees. It said all exports and imports under the invoicing arrangement may be denominated and invoiced in rupee, while the exchange rate between the currencies of the two trading partner countries may be market determined. Many observers say the decision to allow international trade in rupees is aimed at facilitating trade with Sri Lanka, which is running low on forex reserves, and Russia, which has been slapped with sanctions by Western countries. It has also opened a window of opportunity for India and Iran to consider bilateral trade with a rupee-rial arrangement, which was one of the issues discussed by Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri during his recent visit to New Delhi.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Andrei Kortanov from Moscow, the Director General of Russian International Affairs Council. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Kortanov. Now, India's rupee trade settlement mechanism is reportedly generating interest from many countries. So how important is it to end the dominance of the U.S. dollar in global trade?
Well, the special position of the U.S. currency creates opportunities for the United States to dominate the global financial system and to impose secondary sanctions or extraterritorial sanctions on countries which are willing to trade with Russia. If you shift to local currencies, of course it means that the power of the United States is reduced. So if Russia is concerned about these type of sanctions, and it should be, it is in Russia's interest to shift to currencies other than dollar.
So, sir, Russia has already been using this mechanism following the imposition of sanctions in the wake of the Ukraine war. So which countries would benefit from it the most?
Well, what we observe since the beginning of this century is a very gradual, very incremental decline of dollar as the major exchange and reserve currency in the global finance. It went down from approximately 70% of global currency reserves to less than 60%. So there is a decline, but it's not a very steep decline. And many countries would like to limit the use of dollar in their foreign trade, and also to limit dollar as a reserve currency in their financial systems. Probably the most important change is the decision of China to gradually decouple itself from the dollar financial system. China is selling out U.S. Treasury bonds, and it is shifting its trade with Russia to RMB, to the Chinese currency. There are some other countries.
Mr. Kortanov, during Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri's recent visit to New Delhi, the issue of rupee-rial trade figured prominently in discussions. So how feasible is this plan?
You know, I think that it is difficult to imagine that such a plan can be implemented very fast, within a couple of months or even within a couple of years. There is a lot of inertia within the financial system. There's a lot of inertia within the private sector. So I think that even if this process is underway, it will take many years before the fundamentals of the global international system are likely to change. And definitely, you know, Iran and India can agree on some specific bilateral arrangements. I think that since Iran is under U.S. sanctions, that might make it easier for Indians to trade with Iranians. But this is not a fast process. It will take time.
Last but not least, sir, India has in recent months significantly ramped up oil imports from Russia, defying Western sanctions. This rupee trade mechanism is another indication that the country prioritizes its own interests. So does this point to India's growing international clout as an emerging economic power?
To some extent, yes. I think that India wants to make sure that it will follow its own interests, both political and economic interests, and it will not take orders from Washington, D.C. However, India definitely has very vast economic relations with the United States and with the West at large. It doesn't want to sacrifice this relationship. So the challenge for India is to keep a proper balance between the East and the West, between the Indo-Pacific region and Greater Eurasia. It will require a lot of diplomatic skills and a lot of balancing in its trade, in its investment, in its technological relations. So it will really be quite challenging for the Indian foreign policy, but I'm sure that India can make it.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Andrei Kortonov from Moscow for being on the program. He's a Director General of Russian International Affairs Council. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see what people have to say on social media.
Journalist Nikunj Ohri cites the Reuters report that states that India's rupee trade settlement mechanism has attracted interest from countries such as Tajikistan, Cuba, Luxembourg, and